Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Absolute Return podcast. On today's show, we welcome special guest Carson Block of Muddy Waters. Carson is an activist short seller who conducts in-depth fundamental short analysis focused on business fraud, accounting fraud, and fundamental problems. On the show, we discuss his fortuitous path to short selling as a profession, Sinoforest and the short that put him on the map, the thesis behind his bearish view on Fairfax Financial, his approach to risk management when short selling, and more. A point of disclosure, Accelerate may have exposure to securities discussed on this show, long or short. With that said, and no further ado, here's our show on short selling with Muddy Waters, Carson Block. All right, we're here with Carson Block of Muddy Waters. Super excited to get into things today on short selling, which is a strategy that not a lot of people do, not a lot of investors. Obviously, most are long biased. I always say short selling, save it to the pros because Carson, as you know, can be perilous and dangerous, but when approached in the right fashion can be extremely lucrative. And you've had some huge wins as one of the most prolific short sellers out there. Granted, there aren't too many these days, just given the extreme speculation that we've been seeing in the market. But that being said, you know, given it's such a unique profession and short sellers, I kind of view them as the cops or the sheriffs of the market. You try to keep things in check, a rare counterbalance to the unrelenting bullishness that we can see in some particularly speculative markets. Now, that being said, what got you interested initially in the unique profession of short selling?
I'll try to nutshell it because my journey here was quite circuitous, but I grew up in the markets. My father was a sell-side analyst. I would later come to learn that he was literally viewed as being among the most bullish and credulous of management sell-side analysts, if not the most credulous. Little joke. A guy who used to work for my father as his trader used to tell my father, and we're talking about the 90s, he used to joke that the day my father retires, there's going to be this one guy out there who's quit because, or who's just despondent because he shorted everything my father ever put a strong buy recommendation on. And fast forward many years, it's 2010. I had just published on Orient Paper. That was the first short report I ever published on. And I was in New York, and I sat down with veteran journalist Bill Alpert of Barron's, and referring to my father, he said, "I first heard of Bill Block years ago when I took a sabbatical from journalism and worked with a hedge fund, and we had a strategy where we shorted everything your father ever put a buy recommendation on." So my takeaway was it was probably not one guy, but the thing is with my father, like, he really believed these guys. Like, he's somebody who saw the best in everybody and was really taken in by charisma. And like, I grew up initially, you know, we're editing his reports when I was in seventh grade and going to management meetings over my summer vacations with him and learning that managements are good and can be trusted. But, when I graduated from university in 98, I initially went to China looking to open up an A-share research firm, realized it was way too early, went back to the States, worked for CIBC World Markets for that brief moment in time when it was a bulge bracket bank, learn how bankers love to mess around with the RAROC calculations, the risk-adjusted return on capital, you know, the managing director standing over my shoulder saying, like, well, you know, like, start juicing the sales growth rate a little bit and see if this will, you know, clear our hurdle. And then after a little bit of that, I went to work with my father covering on the long side, I mean, covering microcap equities, 99 to 02. And so this was a period when we were getting lied to regularly by these managements. And it wasn't just microcaps, right? Like, this is the same time that the largest companies in the world were blowing up in scandal, like Enron, WorldCom, HealthSouth. So by 2002, I was embittered. I had always wanted to be an investor. I had trained for this like most of my life. And yet I suddenly felt as though I couldn't do that job because I couldn't trust the people in management. And that didn't make me say, hey, I want to be a short seller. That made me go to law school in order to put some tools in my toolbox to make myself a better defensive investor. And, you know, things got circuitous, I'll reuse that word, after that. I ended up back in China as a lawyer. Then I opened up the first self-storage business in mainland China. I thought that was going to be huge and we'd raise venture capital and, you know, but it ended up just being a series of getting, you know, kicked in the balls pretty much every day. And then my father got interested in these Chinese companies that had listed in the States via reverse merger. I really didn't want to take the time to look at them. I had no notion that they could be significant frauds. I mean, I thought, okay, maybe Chairman so-and-so is going to be taking too much money out of the company via reverse merger, or sorry, via related party transactions. But the first one I ever looked at was Orient's paper, and I was stunned that such a thing could actually exist. It had a market cap of $150 million. It had just reported revenue of $103 million, and the real revenue was probably $2.5 to $3 million. And it was just so obvious to me by that point in time, because I guess I was seeing the matrix in China, having, you know, just barely kept my real world business from failing there. So I think it was June 2010, I just put together a report exposing it. I was broke at the time. I was, you know, it just eviscerated my savings in China in that self-storage business and was borrowing money from my father. So I, you know, bought about $2,000 worth of puts that I'd financed with my credit card and published this report on Orient Paper. It went viral, and 1 year later, Bloomberg Business Week named me one of the 50 most influential in global finance with like Ben Bernanke and Warren Buffett and Christine Lagarde. So it was like winning the lottery, really. I didn't know what I was doing at the beginning. It was just like, look, there are these Chinese companies that are lying and I have a skill set to expose them. So write the report, short the stock. Yeah, I pretty quickly hooked up with, you know, people who had a lot more money than I did, which, you know, was zero at the time or negative. And eventually, you know, after almost a couple of years of doing that, I took a step back and realized that the same conflicts of interest, mediocrity, laziness that enabled these completely empty boxes from China to list in the US and in the case of Sinoforest, Canada, it's really what, you know, it's really the root cause of what chased me out of the industry when I was on the long side in the first leg of my career. So, you know, with the wisdom to know that wherever there are rivers of money flowing, as in the capital markets, you're going to attract people who are doing the wrong thing. So if there's borrow and liquidity, then shit, man, I'm going to bet on the darker side of human nature and assume that there are going to be guys out there whose pants I should pull down for doing the things they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, quite the fortuitous route that you came upon from entrepreneurship in China to discovering these Chinese frauds. And the first I did read that Orient Paper report when it came out, and it just opened my eyes to something I never thought of, i.e., American-listed securities with a business in China that was completely made up and their books totally cooked, which was just wild, but opened up a whole new opportunity set over the next few years of uncovering these frauds and scams, which you proceeded to do. You said Orient Paper, small one, 150 million market cap, not a lot at stake, but one that I think really put you on the map was Sinoforest, which was a more consequential market capitalization, if I recall correctly, and that was in about 2011, I think probably about $1 billion market cap with more reputable, quite a bit more reputable investors on the long side. And it created a bit of a battleground stock where you had firms like Paulson & Co., some other smart folks on the long side fighting back on these fraud accusations. And then you ultimately winning the battle, the company going bankrupt. And it was finally unveiled that they really didn't have anything. And there was really Canadian shareholders that thought they owned all these forests in China when they in fact didn't. And you did quite a bit of due diligence into that one, didn't you?
Yeah, well, it's funny though, that was June, early June of 2011 that we published it. So really, you know, like 11, close to 12 months after I'd published Orient Paper. So the funny thing is though, and Sinoforest, I think the market cap was $4 and change billion and had another $3 billion in debt or net debt. But, you know, so back then, I mean, $7 billion EV was like a number. You know, today, I mean, especially the stuff from China that are, you know, still things that are fraudulent, that number is nothing. But yeah, the more bitter battle, which actually led to Sinoforest, was a company that we'd shorted in, I think, February of 2011, called China Media Express. And that had a market cap right around $1 billion. And
was that CMED?
No. This one was CCME.
Okay,
so
right.
CMED was great because later when it was delisted, they added a Y.
Yeah, comedy.
And I think it was John Hempton had this like brilliant blog post on it titled something like "A Chinese Company Called Comedy," honestly, for financial comedy, you really can't beat these Chinese frauds. But yeah, CCME, it was audited by Deloitte. So it was the first one to go down with a big four auditor. It had CV Star as the largest outside investor. So it's like all these retail investors who are long this thing imagined that Hank Greenberg had, you know, lovingly pored over every detail of the business and, you know, with his connections in China could not be defrauded. And and then it also, there was a small investment bank called Global Hunter, I know, that a lot of retail really pinned its hopes to as well. And they had an analyst who just, I mean, I don't think she was corrupt. She was just, and this is what I heard from somebody who used to employ her, she was just a complete idiot. But she ended up going over to China after our first report and saying, oh, I diligenced them and I sat down with these companies that Muddy Waters claims don't actually have deals with CCME. And it turns out they do have deals. And, you know, just, I don't know. So that one was really, really bitter. And there was even a class action attorney, Andrew Leth, wrote on it, Citron Research wrote on it pretty much the same time we did. It was a really competitive business back in those days because they were all frauds. Mm-hmm. It was just a race to see who could expose it first. So there was this one class action attorney who put this website up this webpage where he was looking for plaintiffs to sue Andrew and me. And so there was so much vitriol directed at us, and it all was based on this, what I call the holy trinity of Deloitte, CV Star, and Global Hunter. And one day in March, the stock didn't open, and it was a company halt pending news. And then without opening, like maybe after a day, it was turned into a regulatory halt. And after, I think, 3 days of not trading, the 8K finally hit the system, and it was a resignation letter from Deloitte. And, I mean, it was one where Deloitte resigned with flying colors. I mean, talking about likely hidden debts and assets that don't exist. I mean, it was so graphic relative to the way these auditor resignation letters usually go. So we won. I mean, that was an uncontested knockout. And after that, there was a hedge fund that called me up and said, want to talk to you about a company listed in Canada called Sinoforest. And so that's, you know, that's really what led to Sinoforest. And, you know, we expanded significantly on the work that that hedge fund had done. But, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, Sinoforest wasn't really, it wasn't really that hard because there were so many smoking guns. It had been public, I think, for 16 years in Canada. And it just had done so many bad deeds. Almost had been exposed a few years earlier. You know, I think some, you know, some research, some subscription research firm had questioned whether it was a fraud, and Sino, you know, sued them or threatened to sue them, and, you know, which bottled that up, and they quickly swept stuff under the rug. But yeah, it was Sino was incredible. I mean, it was definitely, it was such a fun project to work on. Just, again, every day it seemed like we had a crazy discovery where one of us would just burst out loud laughing all of a sudden, and, you know, like, oh my God, you're not going to believe this. Alan Chan, this guy was sued in like 20 years ago by a Chinese state-owned enterprise for twice bouncing a $700,000 check. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, all, I mean, there had been a petition to wind up Sinoforest filed by some supplier just 2 or 3 years earlier, you know, in BVI, I mean, that nobody knew about. It was just insane how messed up that company was. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, I think it was rumored that Macquarie was potentially going to acquire the company. All sorts of wild rumors.
Yeah, I think Macquarie had looked a few years earlier, seriously looked at acquiring it.
And speaking of, you know, these first few shorts worked out very well. You know, they all basically went to zero relatively quickly, and you guys were proven right. Now, on another one that I thought was a great report, you guys did awesome work on Luckin Coffee, which is another sort of Chinese fraud, in which they admitted the fraud, yet somehow the stock continued and continues to trade very, very well. So it's a case where you're absolutely right in that scenario. You figure, okay, we should make money on the short or the stock should go down. But this one was a unique one in that the stock somehow did well, at least over time, after the initial crash.
Right. Well, yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there. Number one, though, I just want to make clear, this was not our research. So we were contacted by a fund in Asia, and they had done all this work. They were not going to publish for, you know, like a list of reasons. And you know, it seemed that in this news of this work had gotten around, and you know, basically we were given access to the data room. We spent a few days in the data room validating the high level conclusions. I mean, we did it on a test basis. There were lots of photos and videos and you know, uploaded receipts, things like that. But I then tweeted out that we were short, that we'd received an unattributed report, and I tweeted out the link to the report, and that we felt after going through various validation procedures that it was largely accurate. So, stock dropped. I mean, funny enough, Andrew Left is out there like an hour after we were out there. We were tweeting something like, "With all due respect to Muddy, Citron believes that Luckin is 100% real and we're long." So then it was this, you know, it recovered somewhat. It never got the scrutiny initially that it should have gotten because Andrew's tweet and being long had supported it. But then the fraud was so bad and so obvious that when it was going through the audits, keep in mind that this happened at the end of January of 2020, so this is during the audit. So I guess the auditors then looked slightly harder than they normally do, and they found these huge, you know, supposedly these huge clients who were buying, you know, purchasing Luckin Coffee in gift cards in huge numbers. And they realized pretty quickly that those entities were actually controlled by the chairman of Luckin, and they were fake entities, and these were not, you know, these were fake sales. So then Luckin, you know, then Luckin self-reported like, oh yeah, you know, we're a fraud, stock tanked. You know, and unfortunately we weren't short any at that point because, you know, I was sitting there like, all right, well, that worked a little bit, but, you know, fucking Andrew came along and whatever, whatever. And I had no faith in auditors. I mean, the incentives, especially with these China frauds, the incentives really are for the auditors to not find the fraud, right. You know, because if they find it, then they end up being liable. So I'm pretty sure the auditor ended up having to pay something, you know, meaningful at some point. But yeah, then, you know, the stock was delisted. It was in the single digits, I think. And then, you know, kick out the chairman. And I'm sure everybody left in the company is on the up and up, right? And I'm being massively sarcastic here, but I can't prove that they were in on the fraud in the first place. But whatever. Chairman gets thrown under the bus. Luckin gives back, you know, a portion of the money that it's raised. Then basically it's like, oh, look, you know, we're growing again. And oh, no, these numbers are real. And, you know, and like, I've just lost so much faith in the typical, like, you know, American investor, because they want to have amnesia. Like, this is not accidental that they have amnesia. It's like, it's volitional amnesia. So, you know, a couple years has gone by. Oh, no, these guys are good. Let's buy it. I'm enthusiastic. So here we are, and the stock's back up there. And, you know, hey, look, you can say to people all you want, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, but they don't care. So here we are, and that's why I have a job doing what I do.
And talking about American investor amnesia, we have a similar similar construct in Canada as well, but let's move to your most recent campaign, your recent short on Fairfax. Can you explain why you're so bearish on the stock?
Yeah. So it has three legs of income, and you know, two of those legs are from investments. So share of profits and associates, and gains and losses from investing. And the thing is, Fairfax has been massively manipulating the P&L from investments since at least 2018. And when we looked at the book value of Fairfax, based on, and you know, we think we're reasonably conservative in this, but based on a lot of these machinations and games that Fairfax had played with the accounting, you know, we think book value should be haircut by approximately 20%. And Fairfax right now is trading at a premium valuation relative to where it has historically. And it's, as far as I can tell, at least in our look back, it's, you know, it's never been more manipulative of its accounts than it is now. And it's, and then relative to other insurers. I mean, and one of the things I think people don't appreciate, because you can, you know, if we go back to the, you know, the willful, the volitional amnesia and what I call the lie to me culture that pervades so much of equity investing post GFC. The problem, so you could say, well, hey, they just want to pump their earnings. Like, isn't that good for me as an investor? And the answer is no, because it costs them real cash to do it. They are destroying cash in the process. And I'd say a very clear example and very recent example of this was Q4 earnings of last year got a boost of about $300 million through this transaction called Gulf Insurance. So Fairfax already owned a slight majority of Gulf Insurance. I think it was 50 some odd percent. And this is listed in, I think it's listed in Dubai. So as of March of last year, when Fairfax owned like 55%, stock was trading at about 1.3x book value. Now, Fairfax got interested in acquiring it, and somehow that interest leaked to the market, so the stock suddenly spiked. Now, what a normal rational acquirer usually does in a situation in which it leaks that they're interested in the target, they do not buy it at a premium to that premium that's baked in because it leaked. Usually they, you know, tear people new assholes, you know, the bankers, the lawyers, who did this? You know, why did this happen? We're walking away. But not Fairfax. Fairfax, for some reason, said, yes, you know, we must pay now a premium to the current premium of the stock. So Fairfax ends up buying the rest of the company out for roughly double where the stock had been pre-ripping on the rumor that Fairfax was interested in it. Fairfax buys it out, and I think the rest of it at 2.4 times book for a company. Again, this is an insurer. This isn't a software company. So why would Fairfax do that? In what world is that rational? Well, because it allowed Fairfax to book a $290 million gain on the slug valuation gain on the slug of stock that it already owned. Now, I got to tell you, this is something that we've seen companies in China do. These were generally real companies or companies with real businesses that had fraudulent financials. Like we saw this with Tal Education, on which we wrote in 2018, where they would deliberately overpay for, I mean, in our view, deliberately overpay for minority shareholders' interests so that they could take valuation gains and run them through the P&L. And that's what I think Fairfax did here. I don't think there was any rational economic basis to pay that kind of premium for Gulf Insurance unless the whole point was just to juice the earnings in Q4, which, by the way, without that, they would have lost a lot of money because of the change in interest rates. So if my interpretation is correct, here's your problem. Yeah, they got earnings, but they're like fake earnings there, you know, on that, and it costs real cash. So there are a number of other examples that we've laid out in our report, that many of which are more complex and harder to follow, but that basically requires Fairfax at some point in time to pay real cash in order to avoid a loss or to book a gain. And there are real questions. I mean, there are discrepancies. For example, in the Riverstone transaction, Fairfax seemingly received about $300 million less cash than it should have. You know, we published questions on this right before the call, hoping they would explain the delta. You know, that's the transaction that they did with OMERS. Did OMERS get the money? Like, I mean, this is really, you know, but this is a key question. Or is there a bigger problem where the money actually wasn't paid at all? But, you know, and this is one where Fairfax is also on the hook. It provided a guarantee that some of the assets would be worth no less than $1.3 million. And this just kind of speaks to Fairfax's accounting machinations. That's basically, you know, Fairfax putting a floor on the buyers, you know, on the value of what the buyer bought off it, so that the buyer would feel confident in overpaying. But Fairfax, the way they structured it is, though, if these assets happen to end up being worth more than $1.3 billion, Fairfax gets money. But this transaction, I mean, I think it's like a snowball's chance in hell that those assets end up being worth more than $1.3 billion in the time frame for which this arrangement exists. But from an accounting perspective, it didn't show up as debt, and having that, you know, theoretical potential upside, and that allowed Fairfax to book this big gain on sale. But again, there's cash presumably that's going to come out of Fairfax's pocket on the back end of this. So that's one of the more complex and sophisticated ways that Fairfax does it. So yeah, it's generating, you know, like non-substantive earnings, or I would say, you know, kind of fake earnings, to be a little bit colloquial about it, that cost cash. Now, one thing I want to make clear, Fairfax says in its defense that our accounting, everything that we're doing complies with IFRS. Well, yeah, nobody said it didn't comply with IFRS. I mean, that's one of the, you know, crazy things about this world. And I think something that most people who inhabit it understand, at least in Western societies, is that you can violate massively the spirit of the rules or the spirit of the law without actually violating the letter of the rules and the law. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've, you know, there's been so much erosion of trust in institutions and society. And I think this is honestly the bigger problem. The companies like Fairfax Holdings, Fairfax Financial Holdings, I think are more emblematic of, you know, or are the bigger problem in the world than the Sinoforests are, because the abject frauds are, you know, especially if you put aside the, you know, everything from China that's listed in the U.S., real frauds are actually rare. But this sort of behavior of, well, I'm within the rules and I've got a bunch of lawyers and the lawyers have issued legal opinions and they're, you know, they're well-reasoned legal opinions and, you know, prosecutors going to hate to, you know, prosecute this and because they'll probably take a loss because it's all in the gray area. Like this is what kills trust in markets, in institutions, in society itself. And so, it actually, even though I don't think from my chair, nothing Fairfax has done is illegal, This is the sort of thing that actually pisses me off a lot more than the abject frauds do.
Right. And so what you're pointing towards is manipulation of income statement and balance sheet items and transactions meant to, you know, manipulate earnings that come at a real cost, a negative cost to shareholders. And, you know, we've seen that time and time again. GE was notorious for massaging at its earnings per share to meet the analyst forecast number quarter in, quarter out. And we continue to see that, in not necessarily illegal, but it does not inspire trust, and it certainly does not advocate for quality of earnings out there. And with that said, you know, Fairfax Canadian listed, Sinoforest was of course Canadian listed as well. Do you think shorts and good short targets were more prevalent in Canada, or was that more so circumstantial?
No, I think Canada does have maybe more governance problems as a percentage of listed companies than the U.S. does. Disclosure is not as great, but I think one of the this is a problem that I really see with Europe, but it's similar to Canada, is that you have balkanized enforcement. So now it's somewhat worse in Europe, for a reason I can get to in a moment, but yeah, I know that a few years ago Canada did form a federal securities regulator, but my understanding is that its powers are pretty weak. I think you have it seems to me that among the provincial regulators, you have almost this race to the bottom. It was similar to banking regulation in the U.S. pre-GFC, where, you know, you kind of want to shop for the lightest touch. That's been a real issue. I think that's one of the structural issues in Canada. But, you know, I think there's also, Canada's very, very clubby. And the problem with that is that when judgment can easily be bent. And I go back to the comments about my father. You know, my father was always a sucker for charisma. And you don't get to lead an organization without having some level of charisma. Mm-hmm. Especially as a larger organization that's in a publicly traded company. So I think that the fact that so many people in Canada know each other and they have personal relationships, and you know, they just can't imagine that so and so would have misled them or lied to them. I think that helps make Canada kind of a filthy environment, because when you look at malefactors and what they look for that weakness.
Right.
You know, and that's, I mean, there are a lot of actors out there, and I know people might find this hard to believe, but supposedly 4% of the population, 4 to 6% from what I've read, are sociopaths or psychopaths. And then you've got outside of that, the people who are psychopathic, sociopathic. And, you know, by this, I don't mean that they enjoy chopping people up into pieces. That's called bloodlust. And so the combination of sociopathy and bloodlust is actually, you know, very, you know, quite rare. But these are people who they know how to manipulate, you know, when psychopaths and sociopaths are master manipulators of other people. And time and again, you see them, you know, turn up in the financial markets. And it's hard for people to, it's hard for a lot of investors to admit that they might have misjudged somebody. That's like a real blow to the ego. And that's one of the hard things that we as activist short sellers face, is that there's so many people feel insecure if they've got bamboozled, that rather than taking a step back and looking at things dispassionately and saying, yeah, look, you know, I might have been, you know, bamboozled here, they dig their heels in and hear any bit of what we have to say. And, you know, when you look at our, you know, what we've done in the past, you know, I have to hand it to John Paulson. So when we came out on Sinoforest, he didn't do that. I mean, he got really serious, apparently. I've never spoken to him, but, you know, what I understand is he got really serious internally, and he said, hey, like, spin up, you know, some investigators who know, you know, who know what's going on, who know their way around China, get them on this immediately and see whether Muddy Waters is right. And they came back pretty quickly and confirmed that, you know, we were at least largely correct. And so he got out of it. But I mean, I've been, you know, there've been professional investors numerous times on the other side of us who just refused to admit that, you know, that they were misled. And to be fair, you know, there are a couple of things that I think people should keep in mind in these situations. And I've learned the hard way. I mean, even after I started this business, I was massively defrauded in the early days by a couple of guys who I had led into this business. And what I learned from that is that if I'm looking to be a buyer, if I'm looking, you know, if I'm looking to see whether something makes sense for me to be long, whether it's talent or stock, it's an entirely different mode of thinking than if I'm trying to find holes in the story. It's not, you know, I can't go into something thinking, is this a good investment? And I'm not expecting to possibly come out on the other side being like, oh man, you know, this thing's a fraud, I'm gonna short it. You have to think entirely differently. And so I don't think people should really kick themselves too hard if they have been misled or bamboozled. You just, the point is, don't live with in self-delusion about it, you know, get real, and then try to learn from that experience. But yeah, that's one of the harder dynamics of my business, is dealing with that built-in desire to, that so many people have, to just, you know, ignore what we're saying because of the ego blow.
There'd be ego as well as the long only manager. I mean, really all they can do, the tools in their toolkit are just risk management in terms of diversification and things like that to be able to defend themselves. But on that topic, you know, wanted to talk a little bit about your approach to risk management and trade structuring. When you're looking at these situations, how are you typically structuring the trade? Are you looking to just short the common shares? Are you looking at derivatives such like put options or CDS? Current default swaps, how are you structuring these?
So usually there's not enough liquidity for options to matter. I mean, if there is an options market, because, you know, if you go big in the options market, the tail ends up wagging the dog. Like if you just start buying a bunch of puts, you know, the vol blows out on the puts, stock drops because of the hedging. And like I said, there's, you know, we manage outside capital. So there's, you know, we generally can't buy enough puts to make it worthwhile, but we can buy enough puts that would screw up our entry price. So we usually don't do that. CDS, yeah, man, I missed the golden age of that. You know, like it's, I mean, we're set up. We have pipes where we can do CDS, but yeah, it's, you know, ever since, you know, the Dodd-Frank reforms, you know, took the banks out of using their own balance sheets, you know, and taking prop positions, it's, there's just not a lot of liquidity. Not a lot of these names have, even if they have public debt, they just don't have CDS. Nobody's making CDS on them. So, yeah, if I started doing this pre-GFC, man, I'd probably be worth more by an order of magnitude than I am, just because of CDS. But no, I mean, usually, so we're usually just shorting the underlying. And what we often do is we run our positions usually factor and market neutral. So, you know, we have a factor, we have a software package that identifies the factors that, you know, supposedly explain beta. It might be, you know, 30% growth and 15% momentum, 10% financial services. And so then we go to a counterparty and we say, okay, you know, this is, you know, we want to construct a basket of 30 to 50 names that we can be long, you know, that represent these factors. We try to line up the market, the time zones of the markets, basically. And meaning that if we're shorting something in Asia, we tend not to want the names to be, you know, U.S. names because of the time lag. But yeah, and so then we'll, you know, we try to make it generally for every dollar of the underlying that we're short, we're long that basket for in a dollar. And we, you know, and as we run the position, we rebalance, you know, as needed.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think risk management is just so important when it comes to short selling. And, you know, the list is seemingly endless of those who got just absolutely destroyed on a short that went against them. So I think running it in that market neutral manner makes a lot of sense in terms of risk management and career longevity, to say the least. Now, Carson, before letting you go, one last question. As you look into the current market environment, where do you see the best short opportunities? And for our listeners that are perhaps long onlys, you know, where should they stay away? Where are the major red flags and risks in the current market?
Oh, man. Well, you know, the thing is, we're seldom thematic on the front end. It's in the rearview mirror that, you know, we'll say, oh, wow, you know, it turns out that we were shorting a lot of ESG grifts or green tech grifts, or we're shorting real estate or, you know, stuff in Europe. So, look, I get the impression we, in December, we revealed that we're publicly short BXMT, which is the Blackstone Mortgage REIT. And, you know, that was based on its exposure to office. But since then, we've gotten the impression that real estate, that CRE, you know, across classes, like especially multifamily in the Sun Belt, could be the next shoe to drop. And, you know, I mean, I had lunch with a long time commercial real estate investor just a week ago. And I mean, this guy got his start before the, got his start in the lead up to the SNL crisis. So he borrowed money from these SNLs and made his first fortune. And then next thing he knows, he's handling workouts on these properties with the Resolution Trust Corp. So he's seen two massive booms and busts already, and then the boom that we've had. And yeah, I mean, you know, talking with him and some other people, CRE could be a major, major issue. I think Keith Briette and Woods put out a report a couple of weeks ago about insurance companies that have significant exposure to, was it multifamily? It's just, you know, some of these insurers have, you know, are their exposure to, you know, to vulnerable CRE spots in the U.S. is, you know, like double their capital. So, which I'm not saying that, you know, it erases their capital, but the impacts and knock-on effects of this real estate bust that's sort of moving in slow motion right now could be profound. And I say moving in slow motion because in 23, the market was really locked up and everybody was waiting for, you know, for rate cuts. You had some sponsors that were willing to kick in additional equity. But, you know, rates, you know, the rate cuts that everybody was really hoping for, the magnitude and, you know, and timing don't appear to be materializing. And so maybe the market stays jammed up a little bit more, but at some point in time, the market's going to clear and the valuations of which things are clearing, you know, not just on office, but quite possibly, like I said, on multifamily, are going to be significantly lower. And this could have a lot of, you know, this potentially could have a lot of effects, you know, so banks, insurance companies, and beyond. So that's something I think investors should pay attention to. I mean, I'm not a macro guy, so I don't have a strong view as to what dominoes will fall and when, but it's potentially profound, and it's something that in spare minutes trying to think about and come up with some ideas.
And that's a really good red flag for investors to pay attention to. Just, you know, this week we saw NYCB get bailed out due to these real estate loans. And, you know, these, you can only do so much kicking the can down the road, extending and pretending until you got to face the music. There's that saying, how'd you go bankrupt? Well, gradually, then suddenly. And it can happen very, very quickly, whether it's these regional banks, whether it's the mortgage REITs. There's all sorts of highly levered risks that the house of cards can come down very quickly. So thanks for flagging that. Thanks for coming on the show today. Just an awesome review of all the work you've done on the short side of the business, which is rare and seems to be getting more rare these days with you know, a lot of the grizzled short selling veterans hanging up the gloves. But it's great to see you be successful doing that, and we continue to hope you do so for a long time into the future. So thanks, Carson, for coming on the show today.
Cool. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
All right. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Into the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.